of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana, Rabbana.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were saying, is it a sajiyah, an innate kind of thing, or is it a niyyah, an intentional kind of thing that is better in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? So Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, he says that morals and ethics, it's a gift from Allah that he gives to his creation. فَمِنْهُ سَجِيَّةٌ وَمِنْهُ نِيَّةٌ. Some of this khuluq, this gift, it either becomes an innate kind of action that a person does automatically. Sometimes it is what? An intentional. The narrator asks the imam, and he says to him, which one is best? فَأَيُّهُمَا أَفْضَلْ. The imam said, صَاحْبُ السَّجِيَّةِ هُوَ مَجْبُولٌ لَا يَسْتَطِيعُ غَيْرَهِ. The person who is naturally good, this became a habit for him. He can't do anything else. He was already like that. It's not like he has something else that he can do. And وَصَاحِبُ النِّيَّةِ يَصِيرُ عَلَى الطَّاعَةِ تَصَبُّرًا فَهُوَ أَفْضَلْ. Where the person, where his akhlaq are taken through mind and through intention and through action, the imam says, because he puts effort and struggle in it, therefore he is better. And this, you can see this notion very clearly if you compare the East to the West. Where the Muslims, for example, most of their akhlaq, for those who have it, is not innate, is rather near intentional. They put the struggle into self-purification. Where the majority of the people in the West, you can see that their nature is good. They automatically are good. You know, it takes over them. So if you have to compare, in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which one is better? The one who is just naturally good, or the one who struggles to be good? Obviously, with struggle comes the reward. To the extent that the Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ تَبَارَكَ وَتَعَالَى لِيُعْطِ الْعَبْدِ مِنَ الثَّوَابِ عَلَى حُسْنِ خُلُقِهِ. That Allah gives the servant the amount of reward for his good deed, كَمَا يَعْتُ الْمُجَاهِدِ, as much as he give the mujahid, the person who fights and struggles for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Let's take a break and then we will come back.
Listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Just before the break, we were saying that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves those who struggle for his sake and struggle to purify themselves. Unlike those who are just naturally good, whether they live in an environment that is good or a household that is good and they become good automatically, like they don't put an effort, compared to a person who perseveres to become good. And the hadith says he will get the reward of a mujahid. A mujahid is a person who goes out of his home, out of his comfort, he leaves his family, he leaves his loved ones, just so he can fight for the sake of Allah, for the sake of his country. And then he might die when he goes to war. He's taken into consideration that he might not return to his loved ones again. So he's leaving everything behind, which is a quite big thing to do for a person to sacrifice himself for his faith or for his land. Compare the struggle and that sacrifice to a person who also tries to maintain his akhlaq and try to keep his morality, because it is really a struggle. Becoming good, becoming nice, trying to become more accommodating to people, especially in our modern day, it's not easy. When you deal with so many people, if I couldn't use, you know, a bit of foul language, it would be good. Like, we have a lot of morons, we have a lot of idiots, we have a lot of psychopaths in society today. People, like, sometimes you wonder, like, where is the humanity in them? And you find yourself stuck with such people, and you find that, you know what, I must maintain my akhlaq. It is truly a struggle. And especially when someone does harm by you, someone does wrong by you, and then you have to keep, you have to stay composed and keep your cool and not lose, you know, don't fall under pressure and lose your control, is extremely hard. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the hadith, he compares that struggle to the struggle of jihad, the same sacrifice. And for that, the hadith says, Allah will give you the reward of that person who goes to war and gets killed for his sake. The hadith says, فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ يَغْدُ عَلَيْهِ وَيَرُوحِ. He goes and comes back, right? So he's constantly doing jihad. A person who's doing akhlaq is also constantly doing jihad. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al-Musawi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Iran's embassy in Lebanon held a ceremony to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the abduction of four Iranian nationals in Lebanon. Iranian ambassador to Lebanon lauded the four men as messengers of peace to Lebanon, noting that Israel was behind their abduction.
We are pursuing the case of our four diplomats via diplomatic and legal means, as their fate is very important for us. This ceremony is being held to honor and remember our diplomats, and it helps us shed light on the fate of our kidnapped diplomats. We have repeatedly said that we have documents and evidence showing our diplomats were handed over to the Israeli regime following their abduction. Israel is politically and legally held accountable for their abduction. We will pursue their case until their fate is known.
A military attaché at Tehran's embassy in Beirut, Ahmad Mutavassilian, along with Iranian charge d'affaires in Lebanon, Mohsen Mousavi, an employee of the embassy Taqir Asdiqar Muqaddam, and a photographer for the Islamic Republic Agency, Qasim Akhavan, were abducted on July 4, 1982. Lebanese militiamen from the Lebanese Forces Group admitted to kidnapping the four men who were on a diplomatic mission in North Lebanon. Investigations show that they were last handed over to Israel at the time.
The legal follow-up of this case in the last few years proves without a doubt that these men were kidnapped on a militia checkpoint, and it was proven that they were put in the jails of that well-known militia which was collaborating with the occupation entity. There are testimonies that they were handled over to the occupation forces. The Lebanese government has a responsibility to follow up the case to highest levels, including the International Criminal Court.
Those in attendance called for an objective investigation by the United Nations and the International Red Cross. Although there is information about those who abducted the Iranian diplomats and their whereabouts, the fate of these Iranians remains shrouded in mystery. The families and Iranian officials believe they remain detained in Israeli jails. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
British Indians flocked to central London Sunday to condemn India's ruling government over its failures to protect Indian minorities from persecution. The anger comes after a string of incidents saw huge numbers of India's 204 million Muslims turn against the authorities, which Muslims claim are systematically discriminating against them.
Violence and discriminatory rhetoric against minorities in India has become so commonplace that many onlookers fear that a genocide may be on the horizon. Muslims in particular are fearful, given that Islamophobic hate crimes have run rampant in India.
Accusations against New Delhi include allowing sectarian attacks on mosques, failing to stop anti-Muslim lynch mobs, hijab bans, and the bulldozing of homes in Muslim areas, essentially a type of ethnic cleansing.
What's happened to minorities in India, if you don't know, is it is on the brink of genocide. This peaceful demonstration is not against India. I want to repeat, it's not against India, it's against the government of India. They are not doing anything, they are complacent. They are basically wanting to make India into a Hindu Rashtra and move away from democracy.
I think that it's wrong that there should be hijab bans. It's wrong that people should be persecuted for interfaith relationships. It's wrong that Indian Muslim homes are bulldozed. And it's wrong, as we saw with the Indian farmers, that there's state sanction, sedition and suppression of rights and views and peaceful protests.
India's Prime Minister, who heads the ruling BJP party, has been accused of pushing an extremist Hindu nationalism, which preaches intolerance of other religious groups. Under Narendra Modi's watch, India has been routinely condemned by human rights groups over anti-Muslim discrimination, but the attention of Western leaders has been more focused on building trade with India to help combat economic instability. And that is why, so far, concerns by Muslims in India have fallen mostly on deaf ears. Robert Carter, London.
Donetsk is on fire. The Ukrainian army has been bombing civilian areas of this city for 3 straight days. We travelled to one of the areas hit yesterday and this morning. Markets are common targets for the Ukrainians, presumably because they are more likely to kill, and in the hope of breaking the will of the Donbass people who support Russia.
How can they kill civilians? It's awful. What are they doing? What purpose are they doing it for? We didn't do anything to them. We need peace. We need to work, to raise our children. Terrible things are going on. We have to sit in basements without food or water. We need peace.
Now, our driver has just told us to hurry up. Indeed, one of the women we interviewed also told us afterwards to get out of here quickly, as there could be more incoming. Now, while it's quiet at the moment in Donetsk, frankly, you can be hit anywhere at any time. The hotel behind the market is still on fire. It was hit this morning. Locals tell me the same place is often bombed hours later in the hope of killing those who come to inspect the damage. A piece of deadly shrapnel lies on the road. Now, I've just entered a residential area just adjacent to the market. We've heard that there were a couple of people killed here earlier. A shell pounding the apartments with shrapnel. A woman and her children appear at the window. She tells me it hit a couple of hours ago. Shrapnel smashed through her window. Now, we've just seen people running for shelter. We've just sheltered down ourselves as they've been incoming here. We heard the explosion a little bit, we're way off. But this area is still very dangerous. We strikes any time. Now we were going to try and find the woman, the two people killed, the relatives of them, but frankly my team has said we've got to get out of here as it's just too dangerous. At the market, the anger amongst people is palpable. The women I speak to are visibly angry at me for being British.
You're scoundrels, those who kill civilians, children. More than 200 people have been killed in Donetsk these previous months, not to mention those wounded. So many children have died. It's outrageous. There's no forgiveness for this. They're killers. They're murdering ordinary people for the sake of their own interest. Why don't you look after your own country? All the best to you. What shall I tell my child? That I have no money and we have nothing to eat? That everything was sheltered here? What have you come here for? Do you give me any money? I have to provide for my child and live somehow. And where do I earn money now? I've been working here for 20 years. 20 years, and it's all over now.
Scenes like this are played out across the city every day now, as Western governments and media focus on alleged Russian war crimes. In Donetsk, Ukraine is getting away with murder. The guns and ammunition for these attacks are increasingly being paid by taxpayers in NATO countries. 3 were killed yesterday, 5 the day before, and already today, a 10-year-old girl has been killed. Under the almost constant crash of new explosions, civilians are being slaughtered every day. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Tehran has organized the 4th edition of its International Conference on American Human Rights. The conference was attended by Iranian officials, experts, and the youth from over 50 countries. The event was held on the occasion of the American Human Rights Week in Iran. It reviewed the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the United States' double standard policies. Addressing the event, Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Qari Babadi, said the U.S. is in no position to talk about human rights, given its widespread violations.
One can confidently claim that there is no nation in today's world that has not tasted the bitter taste of the American version of human rights. The U.S. administration should be held responsible to the oppressed peoples who have lost their lives as a result of terrorism, sanctions, aggression, and occupation.
The Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation that can be committed against human rights is to politicize the issue, and this is exactly what the U.S. has done. A senior Iranian diplomat says human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for the expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism.
Today, human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism. Sanctions and terrorism are the main pillars of the American version of human rights. If they are robbed of these two pillars, they may not be able to continue their dominance and plots.
Analysts believe that the unilateral U.S. sanctions are a means of collective punishment of all people, without any exception. Here in Iran, people believe that the title American Human Rights Week seeks to condemn Washington's double standard policies with regard to human rights and reveal this very reality to the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Protesters blocking lanes and taking part in slowdowns on busy roads across the UK.
Give us our country back!
Organized on social media by Fuel Price Stand Against Tax, they're demanding deeper cuts in fuel duty. Chancellor Rishi Sunak announced a 5 pence cut in March, but that has not meant much at the forecourts.
Fuel prices in the UK have hit record highs since the beginning of the year. Only a few months ago, it would have cost roughly $90 to fill up, let's say, a 50-litre tank. But now it'll cost $30 more to fill up that same tank.
And that has put the squeeze on the finances of people. Some have had to quit their jobs because they couldn't afford the commute anymore. Businesses, too, are feeling the pinch at the pump and are passing the extra costs onto the consumers, worsening the cost of living crisis.
Worst of all, the poorest are suffering the most. You can't just switch off your power, you can't switch off your car, you can't switch off your central heating. And when winter comes, people will freeze. All of that, a direct consequence of this government's failure to have a joined-up energy policy, and we are literally paying the consequences.
Among the biggest factors contributing to the fuel price hikes, the UK's green energy policy and Western sanctions on Russian energy exports in the wake of the Ukraine war. Sanctions that the UK government was among the first to impose.
the sanctions imposed upon Russia for political reasons have clearly pushed up the energy costs. But secondly, and even more importantly, Britain has an idiotic environmental policy where they import the very fossil fuels that they depend on, even though under our feet there are £1 trillion worth of gas, and in the North Sea there are billions of pounds worth of oil.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has hinted at a rise in UK oil and gas output, but critics say it would have little effect on consumer bills. And as long as the UK, along with its Western allies, fans the flames of the war in Ukraine, scenes like this may well become more frequent. Saeed Purizab, London.
Thousands of Iranian pilgrims have arrived in the holy city of Mecca for the Hajj pilgrimage. This once-in-a-lifetime journey requires spiritual as well as physical preparation. It's an arduous trip, and pilgrims usually start exercising prior to traveling to Mecca to enhance their fitness levels. However, what if pilgrims got sick or had an injury? To make sure Iranian pilgrims will receive proper and quick medical services during their Hajj pilgrimage, the Islamic Republic's Red Crescent Society has taken special measures. First, all Iranian pilgrims have checkups in the country to make sure they are healthy and in good physical condition. After receiving medical approval to travel to Saudi Arabia, each Hajj caravan is accompanied by a doctor.
Our goal is to bring back all Iranian pilgrims to our country in perfect health. We assure our pilgrims that during their journey, a medical team accompanies them, and in case of any problems, they will receive the required services.
Doctors accompany pilgrims in their hotels and provide outpatient services for them.
Three medical clinics operate 24/7. In addition, a well-equipped hospital in the city of Mecca is currently providing specialized services to Iranian pilgrims.
While so far there have been no cases of serious illnesses or injuries, Iranian doctors ask pilgrims to look after their health.
Older persons or those with underlying diseases should avoid going out in the hottest part of the day, and rather go out at times when outdoor air temperatures are cooler.
Pilgrims should also be cautious about getting infectious diseases and wear masks in gatherings and crowded places. Iran's medical team sent to Saudi Arabia has carried the title of the best team for several years, and the key to their success is the devotion and love of the medical staff.
God has blessed us with the opportunity to be here with a group of our friends. We enjoy the spiritual environment of Hajj and serve the pilgrims of Kaaba.
Serving the pilgrims of Kaaba is one of the biggest blessings that has been bestowed upon me in my life. It has been one of my biggest dreams. I hope to be a good servant for Hajj pilgrims.
Providing different services for Iranian Hajj pilgrims is not only a duty, but rather an honor. Mahdi Abbasian, Mecca.
Highlighting the United States' rights violations at the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran, which the Islamic Republic calls the Den of Espionage. Every year in late June and early July, Iranian activists get together to commemorate the American Human Rights Week to recount instances of U.S. rights abuses in Iran.
United States, who is, you know, shouting the human right, we think that this is just a, you know, slogan without any background. And because when it's go to the Iranian people, we have seen that these people have been targeted, and we do not receive any apology about that.
The week-long occasion marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Rights activists say in all of those instances, the footprints of the U.S. can be traced. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board the doomed plane. More than three decades on, and Iran is still waiting for an apology from Washington. Rights activists believe the U.S. has not abandoned its double standards regarding human rights.
We know that more than 30 countries have received the negative sanctions from the United States. Sanction is something that violates the human rights, the right of the development, right of the education, right of the health.
The American Human Rights Week also marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the formidable Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast. The Islamic Republic says the MKO is responsible for killing 12,000 Iranians in different terror attacks. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, and since then, they have been taking part in the terror group's annual summits in Paris.
They have withdrawn the MKO from the blacklist, and this withdrawal paved the way for the Americans, not only for the Americans, but also for the MKO, to extend their own terrorist operations through the facilities that they are provided from the Americans and also from the European territories.
The 1987 chemical bombardment of Iran's city of Sardasht is another incident that falls on the same period in the Iranian calendar. Iraq's chemical weapons were reportedly produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Activists here say Washington has shrugged off its crimes in Iran. And that's why they observe the American Human Rights Week every year, to take a jab at the U.S. for its selective approach toward human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Alina Lip, a German journalist who has been reporting from the pro-Russian Donbass region of Ukraine for over 6 months. She recently received charges from the German legal system threatening her with 3 years in jail.
On 24th of February, I shared on my Telegram channel the news that Ukraine is killing civilians already for 8 years. And I also said that this is a genocide and that people here in Donbass support the special operation of Russia. And this is a criminal act for Germany.
But Ukraine has been killing civilians here for 8 years. That's just, I think, controversial.
That's a fact. I'm filming here for half a year now, and I'm living in Donetsk, and I'm hearing all the day this shelling around me, and this is not Russia.
And the other one, it says there is that you said that most people here support the separatists. That's a fact as well.
That's a fact, yeah, of course.
A few days after Alina's charge sheet was issued, the main German TV channel ARD ran a story reporting that the Russian army was bombing Donetsk, but then it was the Ukrainian army. The next day, the channel published a retraction and apology. It's not clear how many people who saw the report also saw the retraction.
The courts have also taken €1,600 out of Alina's bank account, money given to her by members of the public who are appreciative of her work. They also say that she is not allowed to defend herself at a hearing. Now, I've read the document, and the only conclusion I can draw from it is that either the German courts are trying to prosecute honest journalists, or that, frankly, they don't have even the most basic grasp of international politics. I'm not sure which one is more damaging to the credibility of the German legal system.
They just want to put me in prison for 3 years, but not hear me out. I mean, what... It's unbelievable. And especially they open this case because I'm sharing my opinion. So there's no free speech anymore in Germany.
Luis Cervera, an independent Spanish-Russian journalist who has been reporting on the suffering of the Donbass people at the hands of the Ukrainian army.
At first, I received a lot of hate comments, hate in general. Then I received also harassment from different people, pursued me. They published my phone number, all my private information. They even published an address of a flat where I used to live.
While Julian Assange faces the prospect of spending the rest of his life in jail, he is not the only journalist under threat of imprisonment for telling the truth. Alina, like many other independent journalists, have been deplatformed from some social media outlets and has had her PayPal account suspended. Anti-war sites Consortium News and Mint Press have also had their PayPal accounts suspended in an attempt to cut off funding.
The job of a journalist is to uncover stories so that society can debate and implement policy based on their findings. Now, while mainstream outlets don't even send reporters to this part of Ukraine, the few Western reporters who are here risk their lives and their reputations to uncover important truths. For that, they risk being deplatformed, smeared, or sent to jail simply for doing their job. There's increasingly a worrying campaign by tech companies, governments, and courts to strangle anti-war dissent in the West. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qumi. Stay tuned.
مجالست کنید من یذکر و کمالله وقتی باش می نشینی بالاخره یاد خدا و پیغمبر و
We as Muslims must accompany those people whose presence remind us about Allah, the Holy Quran, religion and ethics. However, in today's world, our friends are usually concerned with materialistic world. Now, these mundane inclinations will affect our souls and will keep us away from religious values. Accompanying the men of God will improve your spirituality in life.
این تهران خدا رحمت کند مرحوم آیت الله العظمی احمد خونساری رضوان الله علیه
The late Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Khansari was one of the greatest ulama in the city of Tehran. When he passed away, he was buried in a grave beside the grave of the late Allama Tabatabai in vicinity of the tomb of Lady Fatimatul Masuma in the holy city of Qom. The late Imam Khomeini sent a message of condolence on the day this great man passed away. The late Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Khansari was an epitome of religious morality and virtuous lifestyle. Whenever I and other young students went to his sessions, we were affected by the high quality of his spiritual life. Even 1 minute of accompanying this great man could change your whole way of life. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Hosseini Qumi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/en/Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has overtaken Donald Trump as the favorite to win the 2024 election, as the former president's chances appear to have been affected by the January 6 hearings, according to betting market data. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Ewan Palmer. The piece is titled, Ron DeSantis Now Favorite for 2024 as Donald Trump Hurt by January 6 Hearings. The article has been published by Newsweek. In the United States, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has overtaken Donald Trump as the favorite to win the 2024 election, as the former president's chances appear to have been affected by the January 6 hearings, according to betting market data. The Florida governor is currently listed as having a 22% chance of winning the next election, with Donald Trump on 20%, and current President Joe Biden behind both potential GOP candidates on 14%, according to odds on the Smarkets betting exchange. Ron DeSantis' chances have rapidly improved over the past few months. In November, he was considered the fourth favorite to be the next president, behind Donald Trump, Joe Biden, and Vice President Kamala Harris. Even by mid-June, Donald Trump was listed by Smarkets as having a 12% better chance of becoming the next president than Ron DeSantis, 25% to 13%. However, it appears the recent damning testimony from Cassidy Hutchinson during the House Committee's hearings on the January 6 attack have damaged Donald Trump's hopes of returning to the White House. Cassidy Hutchinson, a former top aide to the former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, made some of the biggest bombshell claims of the hearings around the insurrection so far during her 26th of June testimony. These include that Donald Trump was aware that some of his supporters were armed on 6th of January 2021, but still ordered them to the Capitol, as they're not here to hurt me. Cassidy Hutchinson also relayed conversations she heard from Mark Meadows, stating that Donald Trump doesn't care that his supporters were chanting "Hang Mike Pence" at the Capitol, because he believed the then Vice President, Mike Pence, deserved it. The former White House aide also testified that Donald Trump allegedly grabbed the steering wheel of the presidential SUV to force his way to the Capitol as the riot was unfolding, and then attacked a Secret Service agent who tried to restrain him. Since Hutchinson's revelations, Donald Trump has fallen behind Ron DeSantis, with bookmakers having led the Florida governor by 9 percentage points just a week ago. The continued rise of Ron DeSantis has now resulted in the Republican becoming favorite to win the 2024 presidential election, Matthew Shadick, SmartCast's head of political markets, said in a statement to Newsweek. Donald Trump's stock has been on the slide in the recent weeks, and the January 6th congressional hearings may be having some impact. Whilst the latest prices make him odds on to run for the White House again, it's now looking like he may face serious opposition from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. BetOnline is currently listing Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis as joint favorites to become the next president, with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris in third and fourth place. According to a recent Politico website report, Ron DeSantis has viewed the January 6 hearings as a way to get Trump indicted, which could block the former president's attempts to run in the 2024 presidential race and pave the way for the Florida governor to enter the White House. GOP donors are also said to be getting sick of the show surrounding Donald Trump and are looking to support other candidates like the Florida governor, according to a close DeSantis advisor. While DeSantis's polling has improved in recent months, including beating Trump in a University of New Hampshire survey center in June, Trump is still far and away the favorite to clinch the GOP nomination should he choose to run for office again. According to a collection of national surveys since November of 2021, compiled by Polling USA, as of 16th of June, Donald Trump's average polling stood at 55.3%, while Ron DeSantis is a distant second place at 19.3%. Meanwhile, Donald Trump on Sunday targeted conservative columnist Peggy Noonan, claiming she's among the pundits who don't understand MAGA politics or Make America Great Again politics. In a Wall Street Journal opinion editorial on Thursday, Peggy Noonan wrote that the January 6 hearings are sinking Donald Trump and not helping President Joe Biden either.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. You're listening to the program The Teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars and ulama. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
The personality with whom we are mainly concerned for today's discussion is no one but Sheikh Muhammad Reza Muzaffar, one of the most outstanding teachers of the Islamic Hausa in Iraq, whose works had a deep influence on, we can say, the new generation of the scholars of the Hausas, both in Iran and Iraq, and also the Shia lands. Muhammad Reza Muzaffar. Let's first be more familiar with the biography of Muhammad Reza Muzaffar. Sheikh Ziyani, let's start with you, brother.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Sheikh Muhammad Reza al-Muzaffar, or mainly known as Allama Muzaffar,
yes,
was born in 5th day of Sha'ban, 1322 according to lunar calendar, in Najaf. And we should know that his father passed away before of his birthday, I mean about 4 months, 5 months before his birthday.
Oh.
And his father was also a scholar and a clergyman, and was amongst the mujtahideen in Najaf. At the beginning of his life, he was adopted by his bigger brother, Sheikh Abdul Nabi. And mainly he was under the treatment of his bigger brother, Sheikh Muhammad Hassan Muzaffar,
yes,
that was his teacher also.
Yes. Also a scholar.
Yeah.
That's right.
Was Sheikh Muhammad Hassan al-Muzaffar, who was a scholar and was the teacher of Sheikh Muhammad Reza.
Okay.
Sheikh Muhammad Reza Muzaffar started his Islamic studies when he was 13 years old in Najaf al-Ashraf. And as the other students in the field of Islamic studies, he started with Arabic grammar and Arabic semantic.
Yes.
And most of the teachings in this preliminary level was done with Sheikh Muhammad Taha al-Huwaizi and also his bigger brother, Sheikh Muhammad Hassan al-Muzaffar.
That's right.
And after this level, he entered into higher level of studies. And in this level, he got benefit from big names in the city of Najaf at that time, like Mirza Muhammad Hussein Naini, Agha Ziauddin Iraqi, Sayyid Abdul Hadi Shirazi, Sayyid Ali Ghazi Tabatabai, and also Muhammad Hussein Gharavi Isfahani. That all
right.
of these
yes.
names are great scholars
right.
In the scholarly atmosphere of Najaf al-Ashraf.
Really benefited from the presence of outstanding scholars, as you said, in the holy city of Najaf and the Hausa over there, also belonging to the Muzaffar dynasty, or Ala Muzaffar, who were famous for bringing or nurturing, we can say, outstanding scholars and ulama during the history of the Shiite world. Okay, Sheikh Mahdavi, let's get to the scholarly life and the socio-cultural life, spirit say, of Allama Muzaffar. Besides establishing so many centers, schools, we can say, and the foundations, he was also famous for the innovations that he brought into the writing style of the religious books, especially the books that are related to fiqh and usul, we can say an aqaid for the Hausa students and the Hausa scholars. Let's a little bit be concerned about this aspect of the life of Allama Muzaffar.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would like to start my part of the speech with this sentence, which is familiar and famous regarding Sheikh Allama Muzaffar, saying that had he not dedicated his life for these affairs, I mean besides his study, he would have been regarded one of the grand ayatollahs and maraji in the Najaf.
Oh.
All of us, we know him, but not as one of the great maraji of his time, although he was contemporary to Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani. So he had this chance to assume the position of marja'iyya, but since he had dedicated his life for these social affairs that you mentioned, and inshallah we are going to deal with in our program for today, you may say that based on the materialistic issues, he might has lost this position.
Okay.
But
okay.
in fact, he had actually saved his afterlife because of the beneficial efforts that he bestowed and granted for the youth
That's right.
who were contemporary
yes.
to him in his age they were living. So one of the very important things that we know and he had established was the Muntada al-Nashr.
Okay.
So the old
yes.
schools.
Okay.
It is famous that this Muntada al-Nashr institution, it had covered all parts of the study from the kindergarten even up to the university, because it is known that he had established some faculties in which they would go through some levels in order to systematically become a mujtahid. So he had
Muntada Nash is a kind of how we could say is a kind of academic but religious school from the very primary school up to university. Different grades. That's right. Very good.
So besides that, he was creating booklets and all pamphlets, whatsoever was needed, because at that time they didn't have these Islamic booklets and textbook to be studied in the schools.
Very good.
So we have one very nice memory from Ayatollah Bahjat saying that we were actually living in the same school in which Ayatollah Muzaffar was living. So the time we were going to sleep, we would see his light was open, the lights of his room was open, and for the Fajr prayer, where we would wake up to do our Fajr prayer, we would see still the light is
on.
The light was on, and it was on till Fajr, and we would think that might be he is creating and producing these textbook for the children, but we saw these very important books, Usul al-Fiqh, that is being studied in all of the houses as one of the main book for the Usul al-Fiqh. Besides that, Mantiq also. And besides these two, we have Aqaid al-Imamiyya. These are a very great books being produced by this alim that even till now, most of the students of seminaries, they are taking these books and they are going through that.
Very good. But Sheikh Ziyaniya, what was the secret to the success of these books? I mean, was it because, for example, he organized the materials, or no, it was the simplified versions of the very complicated and complex content which was before him? We know that, for example, we had so many great scholars who taught fiqh, usul al-fiqh, at the universities, with the the houses also, with their own books. But all of a sudden, Sheikh Muzaffar comes, and through his innovations, we can say he is successful in achieving such scholarly achievements. What was the secret to his success?
First of all, we should notice that this way or method of compiling new books was not something, you know, brand new to Islamic seminaries at that time. We should note that late Allama Sheikh Al-Ansari rahmatullah alayh was the first in at that generation, I mean,
with Rasail al-Makasib and Faraidus,
who introduced al-Makasib in fiqh, and also Faraid al-Usul and Matarah al-Anzar in Usul al-Fiqh. And his student Akhund Khurasani introduced Kifayat al-Usul to the scholarly community of Najaf. So this was not something new, but about different fields. And for preliminary or elementary students, some new books was in need, and many scholars, they were thinking about it, but it was in need of a person who is capable in scholarly aspect and also be able to write, you know, have good, you know, writing aspect. And this was also important. So, Marhum Allama Muzaffar was the person who was benefiting from both sides. I mean, being a good scholar, beside that, being a good author. And that's the secret, that his books, I mean, for example, Usul al-Fiqh, that is a book who enters the student of Islamic seminaries into this science.
So the materials were not something new,
but
the way of organization of the materials and the table of the content, you know, was something new.
Or for example, about Al-Mantiq, we have many books regarding Mantiq. It was taught, these books were taught in Hawza in Najaf. But Allama Muzaffar decides to compile a book covering all the stuff of Mantiq in a single book. Beside giving new method in this regard, giving new examples, and simplifying the method of the teaching these, you know, concepts.
That's right. You yourself have read such books, you know, in the Hawza studies.
I think all the students nowadays in Islamic Seminary of Qom, and also
is it a compulsion for all the Islamic students, because I've heard so many Islamic, we can say, students of the houses reading out this book. Is it among the courses? Is it the compulsory courses?
It's in the syllabus of Hawzat al-Ilmiya. Of course, recently, I mean, in last 10 years, mm-hmm. some other books have been put in the place of Mantiq al-Mudhaffar, written in Arabic or Persian in Qom.
Okay.
And also some books have put in the place of Usul al-Muzaffar, mm-hmm. like Halqat al-Ula or Halqat al-Thaniya of Shahid al-Sadr.
Oh.
But again, this book has its position.
Position, that's right.
And many students, many, you know...
At least it is an introductory course to be more
even
familiar.
More than introductory. More than, okay. It's something like intermediate.
Oh, that's right.
Introductory up to intermediate that's level. Right. And, you know, this style of being innovator, I think that was transferred to his students also.
Oh.
For example, when we go through the names of the students of Marhum Allama Muhammad Rida al-Muzaffar, we find Sheikh Ahmad al-Wa'ili.
Mm-hmm.
And this Sheikh Ahmad al-Wa'ili, I think all Iraqi people know him.
Okay.
As a person who was really prominent in giving lectures and being a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever we go to Ziyarat of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam, mm-hmm. especially at the moment of Arba'een Walk, we see that people in Mawakib are broadcasting and are playing the voice of Sheikh Ahmad al-Wa'ili,
yes.
reciting Rawda and Musiba of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. And this shows the influence of Allama Muzaffar also,
mm-hmm.
that his students was nurtured in a way that they also were able to have a good connection with the community and people of Iraq.
Okay. Okay, any mispoint, Sheikh Mahtavi, about the scholarly life of Allama Muzaffar?
Also, he is known of... unification, I mean, mm-hmm. bringing all Muslim or having this concern to bring about unity among Shias and Sunnis.
Okay.
And he had good contact with the head of Al-Azhar,
yes.
specifically during the 6-day wars of Israel against the Arab.
That's right.
So he sent his condolence letter to them.
That's right.
Actually condoling on this bad thing that happened to the Arab, specifically in Egypt. So he is also known of this. Next to other ulama, he was trying to initiate unity among these two sects of Islam, I mean Shias and Sunnis.
That's all right. Really a source of benefit for the students of the Hausa and also Hausavi scholars, you know, all around the Shiite world. This outstanding man passed away on Ramadan 16th. 1383, according to the lunar Hijri calendar, in the holy city of Najaf, and his body was taken into the grave or beside the grave of Sheikh Muhammad Hassan al-Muzaffar, his brother. We can say he was buried over there. The establisher of Muntada Nashr Society and also the compiler of so many outstanding books like Usul al-Fiqh, Al-Qaid al-Imamiyya, and Al-Mantiq, which are still used and studied by so many students all across the houses of the Shiite world. May Allah bless the soul of the late Allama Muhammad Reza al-Muzaffar. Thank you much, Sheikh Zainia and Sheikh Mahtavi, for your presence in the program, Teacher, talking about the late Allama Muhammad Reza al-Muzaffar. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.